It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Each month at this time, we welcome Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto to the program to talk about important issues facing the city. Mayor, it's been a while. We know you've been busy. It's good to have you back. How
it's
are
nice
you?
To be back. I'm back in beautiful new studio.
Yes, yes. We were hoping you'd like this.
It meets my my double thumbs up. I love this table, by the way.
Yeah.
So those at home listening.
Handcrafted
tree.
Yes.
That has been cut in half and is natural and beautiful.
Well, we're glad you like it. We're glad to have you back. And if you have a comment or question for Mayor Peduto, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. First of all, you've been doing a lot of traveling. You've been getting around and looking into a lot of different things.
Yeah. Actually turning down more than I've accepted, and just recently was one of about a dozen mayors that were invited to France to address climate change and to present Pittsburgh's story, and I had to say no. But it was quite an honor. It was the mayors of Bristol, Bilbao, Istanbul, Pittsburgh, and a few others. And you know, I had the opportunity about a year ago meeting with former Congressman Ron Klink to start talking about Pittsburgh-Cuban relationships. And we brought the ambassador, they don't have an ambassador, but the de facto ambassador to Pittsburgh last September. Then we sent a delegation down to Washington and met at the Swiss embassy last December and had planned for a trip in March that had to be rescheduled because of an international conference happening in Panama City where the Cuban officials were going to be. But brought seven CEOs down to Havana to meet with the top government officials, the Minister of Finance and Investment, the Deputy Minister of Construction, the head of their Chamber of Commerce for the entire country, and the people who lead one of their major ports. And all seven are going back. We had a really great response as these sanctions get lifted. There's already opportunity for building materials and food to be allowed to be brought in. And one of the groups we had there was 84 Lumber that has operations in South America, the Caribbean, Mongolia, China, and soon to be Cuba. So it's important to get in early. Last week I was a member of one of 64 mayors from around the world at a global summit based on sustainability, hosted by an organization out of Singapore and by Mayor de Blasio. And it's kind of interesting because you're sitting there and the mayor to the left of you is from Petra, Jordan, the, you know, ancient city. And the mayor to the right of you is from a province of Vietnam. And I got to be one of the few mayors asked to do a presentation about Pittsburgh. Most of the people in the room had probably never heard of it, but told the story of the transformation. And boy, does that story resonate. And every mayor there had a story back and had really good conversations with a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations. One side note that you would enjoy, the mayor of Saskatoon, who was there, former Penguins goalie, Atkinson, behind Gary Innes in the 70s. And he came up to me immediately, and he was telling me the story, and I'm like, I do remember you. But I won't tell you what he said and why he left Pittsburgh, but it had to do with being the second goalie and not the first.
Well, Gary Innes was pretty good, so, you know, that's no shame in being number two to that guy back in the mid-70s when, boy, if they'd have just knocked off the Islanders. But, they, you know, you cried over it. I think I cried over it, but, you know. It's
Bobby Nystrom, Eddie Westfall.
It's 40 years later, and unfortunately,
by the way, and this has nothing to do with the audience, but I always thought of Bobby Nystrom and Fred Biletnikoff as the same person, with that blonde hair and out of the back of the helmet, and
the dark eyebrows,
and they always destroyed their played dirty against the teams that I loved.
And well, Biletnikoff was from near here, well,
Erie. Yeah.
So, you've now made this the very difficult transition. But one of the topics I wanted to address is not a pleasant one, but as you know, it must be addressed. It has been another tragic week with regard to senseless homicides in the Pittsburgh area. More than half of all killings in Pittsburgh went unsolved in 2014, which was the city's deadliest year since 2008, and we seem to be on track for another year like it in 2015. What is being done in Pittsburgh to curb these killings and make some attempt to improve the solve rate of these killings?
Well, Chief McClay, you know, we right now we have a low solve rate, and it's in the 40s when most of the time you're in the 60s. Because we have a low homicide number, it equates to about 10 to 15 cases that either puts us at the top or where we feel that we are at the bottom. So he reached out to an organization out of Washington, D.C. that works with the Department of Justice. They came into Pittsburgh. They bring homicide experts to work with our homicide detectives and to go over best practice models of investigation. It's a great learning experience. It's part of what he's been doing. He's created a leadership academy within the police bureau. He's created a performance and evaluation function within that's an internal part that makes sure that our officers are getting trained on the best practices. But it's important to realize, too, what we see in homicide, and this is across the country, not just in Pittsburgh, is it becomes cyclical, not based on calendar year, but by events. And when you have an event that occurs, you'll see a retaliation event occur, and then you'll see more events happen around that. The best way to cut that cycle off is to have intel that can become a critical part of being able to get the bad guy quickly. And the best way to do that is to build out community relations, to be able to have the eyes and the ears of people on the street feeling confident enough of giving information to police. The police then have the ability to get after the people and have witnesses to be able to put them away. One of the other things the chief's changed recently is forever we have had a policy that homicide detectives only investigated fatal cases. And if someone gets shot, it could be an eighth of an inch that made a difference between a shooting and a homicide. So we now have detectives working on all the cases involving gun violence. And what that does is it's the same people. It's the same guy that took a shot at somebody one day that was able to kill them that the next day wounded them. But the information and the gathering of information by our detectives now is being called together.
You mentioned that the cycle of killings happens around an event, and it's interesting because Pittsburgh is one of two cities that have been involved in this program that you described. The other is Baltimore, and obviously the event there was Freddie Gray dying in police custody, which led to protests and rioting, and Baltimore saw its highest number of killings in 40 years last month. What would the event be in Pittsburgh?
Well, it wasn't. It was a proactive chief. It was not waiting for it. In cases that we saw last year, there were some incidents that were occurring in the north side in Northview Heights. And then over the course of a few weeks, you'd have six homicides occurring, but even more shootings occurring. And it becomes turf wars. It becomes areas where drugs and drug distribution is being challenged, and people then start turf wars over it.
So because the police chief is being more proactive in dealing with this types of crime, it's spurring this kind of activity?
No, because the reason that they came in to town, the reason that they came into Baltimore was Baltimore was reacting to a spike.
Right.
The chief wanted to be able to get ahead of it, realizing that our solve rate wasn't where we wanted it to be, and wanting to find out to train our officers on the best practices in order to get a higher solve rate.
And the homicide rate, along with the non-fatal shooting rate, I mean, these have been Pittsburgh's toughest crime rates to reduce. Chief McClay says that crime rates in other categories are down so far this year. So why is it that it's been harder to solve these homicides and these non-fatal shootings?
I don't know if I could answer, you know, with any authority to that, and I'd leave that to the police to be able to do. I would say that the reason that you see homicides increasing is you see the distribution of drugs, mainly heroin, and crack cocaine is still there, but the distribution routes are being challenged by other people from different neighborhoods and you see the turf wars occurring with it. There, I think there's a direct correlation as well with having a low solve rate and higher incidence of homicide, because it's, in the most part, the same people who are killing people. It takes a certain individual to be able to get a gun pointed at another person and pull a trigger. That's not something that most people have the ability to do or would ever consider doing. But when you have somebody like that and there's a low solve rate, chances are they're going to be killing other people.
412-246-2002, the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation with Mayor Peduto. We have Don from Homewood on the line. Don, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Well, Mayor, first of all, thanks a lot for bringing in that new innovation to try to make things change within the homicide department, and I think that's where the problem lies. I don't think, unless you start changing detectives, firing detectives, or really putting that performance evaluation review minus the unions and everything else that you have to deal with. In other words, the managed change within the department that hasn't seen a lot of change is going to be very difficult. And I'd like to really understand how you plan to implement this change.
Well, you know, there's a completely new command staff, and it goes well beyond the chief. Most of the people that were in the command staff last year are no longer there. And there's a lot of new blood that has been brought in. Commander Sirocco out of Zone 3 has been moved over to major crimes. You got a go-getter there who is the type of person who is, I think, what you're calling for, the invigoration that you need within a homicide division to be able to do that. The other part is beyond the training that they got from homicide experts from around the country in the past month. There's an ongoing partnership that we've created with the Department of Justice in one of few cities around the country to create over the next few years the model of community policing. We could hire another 200 police officers. It will have some effect, but it won't have the better effect of having a community that's engaged with the police force. And to really take it right down to the level, and I hope you've been noticing in Homewood, our officers have been engaged in participating in community events that occur, not there for the safety purpose, but when a peace march happens, marching in the march, getting more engaged in the community. We're bringing back the Police Athletic League so that officers and young kids have the opportunity to see each other differently. And we're working it from both ends, from the very top and the very bottom, to be able to not only just solve crime, but to try to stop crime.
412-246-2002 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, who's making his monthly appearance today. And we'll move on to some other topics, but certainly if you have a question about some of the unsolved murders that have happened in Pittsburgh, you are more than welcome to continue on that topic. We will move on to some other things that are happening. And it's been about 6 months since City Council introduced a bill that would require all rental property owners to register with and pay a fee to the city. A public hearing on the matter was held way back in December. The bill has continuously been held by council and has yet to come up for even a preliminary vote. And apparently today it was held again. What is going on here? What frustrations does this present for you?
Well, you know, we're going to be sued. And the Realtors Association has already told us that the moment that we pass any bill, we're going to be sued. And what's really unfortunate about that is every other city in Pennsylvania has the exact same thing we're asking for. Almost every city in this country has it. And we have irresponsible landlords who allow a property on a street to fall into disrepair, who then we have to go through an archaic bureaucratic legal system to try and get them to do something as easy as fix a window or have a porch attached back to a house or maintain a property. And we don't have the majority of the people who do real estate have more responsibility than that, but they're protecting the bad guys. So we have to have a legislation that's going to withstand legal challenges that are going to be thrown at it to protect bad people who rent property that they in their homes that they live in would never let their property be like that. And at the same time, to be able to get at least 5 members of council to be okay with it, because they're going to be attacked by the Rental Realtors Association and the others as well. It's unfortunate. Like I said, even Mount Oliver Borough, which is in the city, I mean, the city surrounds it, but it's its own borough, has rental registration. And what we want to be able to do is the same thing that a building, if you put a sign on your building, you have to pay a fee. You have to have an inspector come out. You have to make sure that that sign's not going to fall and bump someone on the head. But there is nothing about the people that you put inside, and you're running a business, and you don't have to have a business license, and they don't want any type of uniform inspection for occurring. And so what we have is a system that's reactive. When something gets so bad that the neighbors can't deal with it anymore, and they call us and we send an inspector out, what we're saying is that hurts our neighborhoods. And what we'd rather see is a system that proactively inspects on a basis that's uniform, on a regular basis, and make sure that those that are operating a business of warehousing people are under a regulated system so those people are safe. The community has input in when it's gone south, and that it's done in the proper fashion. And unfortunately, it's going to be, and we've been told, it's going to be challenged because those folks don't want to have to pay $50 a year. $50 a year. And what they say is, well, the rents are going to go up.
For $50 a year.
They're going to go up $4 a month?
So, I have a follow-up question, but we have a caller on the line, Nick from Lawrenceville. Let's let Nick get in on the conversation. Nick, you're on with Mayor Peduto.
Hello, Mayor Peduto. This is Nick. First of all, I'd like to say that the implementation of that project or that program would be unfair because originally the UPMC, or not UPMC, but Pitt, the colleges, the HUD, were all included, and Pitt fought vehemently against it. They excluded themselves. Now they're for it. Unless all properties are included, including HUD, including Pitt, including the other colleges, I don't think that's fair. And second of all, if they need to find the owner of a property, it's a matter of public record on the taxes. It's easy to check. I know here in Lawrenceville we're going through a voting phase now, and voting inspectors are everywhere. First of all, there aren't enough of them to actually cover the area, but they do come in and they check, and if they see you doing work or if something's out of spec, either they see it or the neighbors see it, call it in, and the voting inspector comes in and inspects. I don't see why we need to spend additional taxes, a fee, when we're really not getting anything for it. It's very easy to inspect.
Okay, Nick, two things with that. Number one, up until 2004, as a renter or as a real estate person that rented property, you had to pay the city a percentage of your gross rentals. You were required under the business privilege tax that we eliminated that cost you a percentage of all of your rentals that you received. What we're asking for is a fraction of that. So you've had a tax decrease, a massive tax decrease that has been picked up by the people who actually live in the city to be able to let those that rent property get off without having to pay anything. Number two, there's a reason that this is in every city. It isn't that people that own the properties live down the street and you can go knock on their door. You go over to the South Hills and to Carrick and other areas, they're being bought by an LLC out of Israel. And it's kind of hard to contact the owner in Israel when the property itself doesn't have windows and has towels jammed in it. Well, with the rental registration, we're going to be able not only to track them, but be able to hold them more accountable and have a local person that is now responsible that we can call. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put their phone number in front of that house and have people call them at 3 a.m. because they're disturbing their life. And if you're a good person and you take care of that property, you won't have to worry about it.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Mayor Peduto here on Central Pittsburgh. Earlier this month, you issued an executive order addressing the city's infrastructure needs and maintaining challenges and dealing with maintenance challenges. What can you tell us about this? This is a big challenge.
We're losing our assets. I mean, literally, we are losing control of our fixed assets, and it goes well beyond our buildings. Our buildings are in deplorable condition, not because of what we've done for the past 5 years, but what we've done for the past 10 to 15 years. And they're not going to be able to be fixed overnight because we never put the investment in to take care of them. So with our buildings, what we're doing is looking at three options. We're looking at the buildings that we need for the next 20 years and then what investment needs to be made into them. We're looking at the buildings we don't need and those that are in hot market areas. Why should we have these big storage areas and parking lots for vehicles in Lawrenceville when we know Lawrenceville housing is at a premium? And why not start moving those operations into neighborhoods that haven't seen any type of development and open those up for real estate development? And then the third thing we're doing is we're looking at options with facilities that we may not be able to afford and look for nonprofits and other partners in order to be able to provide human services back to people, the Boys and Girls Clubs and the other types of organizations to take on these assets. Some of them are 19th century buildings that we don't want to see a developer come in, demolish and build a drugstore with a big parking lot around it. But there are icons to that neighborhood, sure. But we don't have the ability to afford to fix every one of the roofs. We just don't have that money. So it's called a fixed asset management system. And it starts with the buildings. And then it looks at our steps, our hillsides, our urban forest, our playgrounds, our swimming pools, and all of the assets that the city government operates. And we say, how do we afford over the next 10 years to get them into maintenance? Our streets, all of these different parts have to have a plan for 10 years. And then we expand it to a 40-year plan as well. It's the first time that we've ever done this. When we took office, we didn't have a list of our buildings. There was no list. There was a list in Public Works of Public Works buildings. Parks and Rec had a list of some of their rec centers and everything else. We had a list of some of the warehouses, but there was not one list.
There was no master list of all the city property?
Correct.
Wow.
So we had to start by pulling together from all the different departments, all of the properties, then going and finding that it still wasn't complete. We had properties that we didn't even have marked down that people knew about, and we had to add them into it. So we start from zero. We're now at the process where we're putting together the capital plan for these facilities, and then you have to invest. You have to dedicate on a 10-year basis how much money you're going to put in each of them. Let me give you one example. Back in 1990-something, then Councilman Dan Cohen, there was an incident that happened up in the North Hills. A little girl died at a playground because the playground equipment wasn't safe, and he decided that's not going to happen in Pittsburgh. And he put together a master plan for 7 years that would upgrade all 160 playgrounds in the city of Pittsburgh. And council said that's a priority. So they figured out how much it would cost to do it, and they split it out over 7 years, and everyone stayed dedicated to it, and it had its place in the capital budget. That's what we want to do with our roads, with our buildings, with our steps, with our retaining walls, with all the different things that we have. And with the buildings, we have the opportunity not to have to pay to fix them all, but the opportunity to sell some and to give some others away.
Last month, you were in Harrisburg lobbying for municipal pension overhaul. And I'm wondering if you've been frustrated by the pace at which this is happening, as others are.
You mean since 2007?
Yeah. Like that.
No, yeah. There was an organization even the organization's changed its name since then. It used to be the Pennsylvania League of Cities and Municipalities. Now it's the Pennsylvania Municipal League. Sort of sounds like where the superheroes hang out, right?
Right.
But anyways, in some cases it is. But Democratic and Republican mayors and council members from around the state and all the different distressed communities of the state got together to figure out what are the core issues that keep our cities under financial crisis. And one of the major issues was pensions. And it's not a political issue. It's
you've been harder on the Democrats than the Republicans.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't mean to be hard on anybody with it. Democrats usually represent urban areas, and every urban area leader has said this is our most important issue and we need your support for it. They have a different view of how to solve it in Harrisburg. with the Democratic side. And the strange part is, for the most part, Democratic, I guess all Democratic mayors are more supportive of the Republican solution, because it's not a problem that's going to be solved by throwing more money at it. You can't, you know, the idea is sell your assets. You have a water and sewer authority, sell it. Well, that water and sewer authority provides revenue back that we won't have. And then where do we make that up? It's not an option to be able to just throw money, because the hole in the boat is bigger than the bucket. And you're taking on more and more each year. You have to change the system. And that's not a political stance. That is the numbers. Those are the numbers. The numbers speak for themselves. There's no way to solve it by borrowing money. The other solution is take out bonds, put the bonds in. We did that. We did that back in the 90s, and we still have a debt ratio in the city that's 20% of our entire budget. That's higher than New York City's was in the 70s when they went bankrupt. One out of every $5 that I pay in my budget every year simply goes to paying off old debt. You can't operate a city that way. So those solutions aren't solutions. They walk away from the real issue and basically try to push it off to the side. So on Thursday, the Republicans are going to bring up in committee a bill. I'm not 100% supportive of it, but it's much better than the alternatives that are being suggested. And the House already took it out of committee, House Bill 316, about 2 weeks ago. Republicans are expected to approve it, but there's no guarantee. And then both bills will be before the full Senate and the House, more than likely being held while the budget is being discussed in Harrisburg. But coming back in the fall, and with Democratic mayors from across the state of Pennsylvania and Republican mayors, both of them, no, just a joke, Republican mayors from Pennsylvania as well, joined by the Chambers of Commerce from the eastern part of the state and the Allegheny Conference of Community Development from the western part of the state, saying that unless we change the system, these cities that are under financial distress, the best they'll ever do is remain under financial distress.
So that would mean that there'd be no light at the end of the Act 47 tunnel.
Yeah, you'll never be able to do it. And here's the thing. When people hear it, it doesn't affect anybody who is presently an employee. It changes the system for anybody who comes in and accepts that job in the future. And the only way that everyone who is presently an employee is ever going to see their pension, including me, is if we change the system.
Getting back to the landlord issue, Jason on Twitter asks, is there a consideration for a reduced fee on landlords who are city residents?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no bill right now that's why council keeps holding it. And I think that once the bill is introduced, there will be an opportunity for a lot of different considerations. I think that there should be something to reward those that are in compliance every time. There should be a way to either through potentially a write-off or the ability if somebody has just a few units that may be in their own home, or if somebody has a ton of units where the cost of doing an inspection would be greatly reduced because you just are checking each of the units on not the specific ones. Going back to Nick's concern as well, and I didn't mean to dismiss that part of it, with the universities and the hospitals and why we're not charging the rooms at both, there is something in the law which prohibits us from the ability to do that. And I'm not sure specifically what it is, but I want to assure Nick and
Jason on Jason, Twitter,
that there will be a deliberate procedure that will go through, and with a bill in front that has the specifics, an opportunity to address it to make it better. But I don't want to walk away from not having a rental registration program. I want to be able to work with people to make it better, and I do want to reward those that are the good landlords.
And so where do you see that going? I mean, the city council just seems reluctant to do anything at this point.
I think that they will. I think it will happen this year. There's three big issues that I think, you know, there's going to be more, but the council will be dealing with later this year, one being rental registration, another food trucks that, you know, that there had been a an understanding that that would be an issue that would come up during year two. I think they'll be looking at food truck laws and the third campaign finance reform and getting that issue resolved once and for all.
And as far as what's the food trucks, I mean, that's such a big thing in this city. What do you see happening with that?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there are those that say, get rid of the laws, just let people sell. And do you know what will happen? Because it's already happened when we were discussing the bill before.
Get rid of the laws, which means, you know, regulating.
Just no regulation.
No inspections, nothing like that?
Inspections. But, you know, if I want to pull up in front of an Italian restaurant and sell pizzas, I should be able to. And you shouldn't be able to tell me I can't, you know, go and I can use meters for 12 hours a day. But you have to understand that then you're hurting the businesses
right.
that are in that neighborhood, not directly because of the food, but also because you're taking up the parking where their customers are. So there has to be a certain level of and even Portland, which is the mecca of food trucks, has these common sense rules in place. The other thing is there are major operations operating out of Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and New York that are watching Pittsburgh. And what they'll do is they'll send 40 trucks in and all of the folks that are here right now, the taco truck, Franctuary, and the others, will be pushed out of business by out-of-towners who are coming in and basically just taking over the market. And for the folks that have helped to build the food truck industry here, there needs to be a way in which the growth happens so that they can be a part of that success and not necessarily open it so that folks from out of the city come in to take it over. It's happened in other cities, and there's a few years ago, the word was on the street, and they were already getting prepared to get new trucks into Pittsburgh. there's a balance that needs to be struck.
Mayor Bill Peduto, we've had a nice visit.
Thank you.
We covered a lot of topics and quite a bit of ground, and we'll look forward to seeing you next month. Mayor Peduto joins us each and every month on Essential Pittsburgh. As always, Mayor, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Paul.
Coming up, we'll look at Point Park's pivotal role in American history and the birthplace of Pittsburgh. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With its lush landscape, winding trails, and dramatic views of the Pittsburgh skyline, visitors from around the world flock to Point State Park, a National Historic Landmark. But many visitors may not know that the triangular parcel of land where the city's three rivers meet played a pivotal role in American history and as the birthplace of Pittsburgh. Here to talk about the history behind this story is Andy Masick. He's president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy Masick, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
You know I love talking about history.
I know that you do, and we'll start with this question. Why was the Point considered such an important strategic location throughout the 18th century?
Well, it was young George Washington, 21-year-old George Washington, red-haired, lanky Virginian George Washington, who discovers the confluence of the rivers here and says, wow, that's strategic. Anyone who's going to occupy this western territory, if they put a fort there at the Point, well, they could control these rivers and access to the west. So it goes all the way back to 1753 when young George first came to western Pennsylvania.
French troops invaded Trent's fort. They renamed it Fort Duquesne. How did the British eventually recapture the fort?
Well, as you know, the British got there to the Point, started building a little fort, Fort Prince George, but the French came down hard from down the Allegheny River, and they captured the Point and built Fort Duquesne. Well, the British couldn't stand for that, and they sent an expedition under young George Washington. He's still in his early 20s, and he loses his whole command at Fort Necessity near Uniontown today. It was just a little stockade he had built there, which became a fort of necessity when he was surrounded by the French and their Indian allies. So he didn't capture Fort Duquesne. It took, another expedition under a guy named Braddock, Edward Braddock. And he came back in 1755, and it looked like he was going to roll all the way to the point, but he got waylaid, where the town of Braddock is today, where the Edgar Thomson Steelworks is. That British column was just decimated in the forest by a French and Indian force. George Washington was the only British officer left standing at the end of the day with 4 bullets through his coat and his hat shot off his head. General Braddock was dead. Washington came back another time in 1758, this time with General John Forbes. And Forbes was a Scotsman, and he brought a powerful army with him. The French saw that there was no way of stopping them. They blew up the fort and bugged out up the Allegheny River. And George Washington and General Forbes rode in and found the smoldering ruins of the fort.
So we know about Duquesne, but where does the name Pittsburgh come from?
Well, General Forbes was from Scotland, from Edinburgh, in fact. And he turned to Washington and said, "What are we going to call this place now?" And the two officers thought about it for a minute. And it was Forbes who probably said, "Why don't we call it Pittsburgh? We'll call it Pittsburgh," with an H on the end, kind of like Edinburgh. And Washington thought it made all the sense in the world. The British Secretary of State, you want to make friends with that guy. And Pittsburghers have been proud of the H on the end of their name, well, till today. But there was a period between 1890 and 1911 that Pittsburgh lost its H. It became a burg. And the post office and the U.S. Geographic Names Board decided they were going to standardize all the burgs in America. And burgs are more German. They're not burghs like the Scottish have. And so So Pittsburgh lost its H, and the people of Pittsburgh petitioned Congress to get it back. So during that period, 1890 to 1911, Pittsburgh doesn't have an H. 1911, we got our H back, and we're proud to have it today. Pittsburgh.
And there is a Pittsburgh, North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. So does that have anything to do with what you just talked about?
It's the same British politician that they were honoring. There's a Pittsburgh Landing in Tennessee. There's a Pittsburgh in California. There are lots of Pittsburgh, but those early names on the Eastern Seaboard are all named for William Pitt.
So where can visitors learn more about the birthplace of Pittsburgh?
Well, I'd encourage them to go right to the source, to the Fort Pitt Museum located at the Point, where you'll find wonderful exhibits, lifelike figures and artifacts related to the colonial period here in Pittsburgh. It's where Pittsburgh began, and it's the best place to begin your historical tour.
Fascinating information. Thanks, as always, to Andy Masick. He's president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In honor of World Refugee Day, Pittsburgh will hold its 4th annual celebration in Market Square on Friday. That's this Friday, June 19th, hosted by Vibrant Pittsburgh and the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. Kir Mugwaniza is Director of Community Assistance and Refugee Resettlement at the Northern Area Multi-Service Center, and he's joining us to explain what the Pittsburgh community is doing to welcome the city's many and populous immigrant and refugee communities, as well as outline the services available to those who are still in a place of isolation. Kir Mugwaniza, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me here.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. First of all, Keir, explain what World Refugee Day is and what it's all about.
Okay, thank you. So World Refugee Day is an opportunity for people all over the world to celebrate the refugee struggles, where they lived in refugee camp, to get where they are now. But it's also an opportunity to remember millions and millions of refugees who are still struggling in refugee camp. But for us here in Pittsburgh, it's also a way to celebrate the many cultures and refugee communities that we have here in our city.
And what do you feel refugees in Pittsburgh, in the Pittsburgh region, in terms of how the community reacts to them? Is the Pittsburgh region a welcoming place for the community of refugees that come here?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And over the years, for refugees that who are been coming here, people in our neighborhood where we place refugees are very friendly. But we need just to do more than, you know, just being friendly. And, you know, we need to get involved in learning to know who they are. And working with the local government and, like, the you know, probably know about the Welcoming Pittsburgh Initiative. So we need to do more than that. But in general, in our communities, people are very friendly to refugees.
And how many refugees, roughly, would you say that we have just here in Pittsburgh?
Well, so every year we have 500 refugees coming to Pittsburgh, about 500 refugees. And there are four refugee resettlements involved in the whole process. There's a northern area, Malta Service Center, which is our, where I work. There's Jewish Family and Children's Services. There's Catholic Charities. And there's Ajapo. So, but beside that 500 refugees, there are also refugees who moved to Pittsburgh from other cities. The 500 are the people we resettle here in Pittsburgh who come overseas from refugee camps straight to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a large number of refugees that just move from other cities. They are called secondary migrants. They move from other cities to Pittsburgh.
That's interesting and probably something that we don't think about all that much. So where would these, the second, you say they are
secondary migrants.
Secondary migrants. Where are most of them coming from? And what cities, what other cities in the United States? And why are they coming to Pittsburgh? As you know, what is mm-hmm. what is bringing them here?
Well, so what most of them are saying, they come to Pittsburgh because it's affordable to live here, and jobs are available. It may be entry level jobs, but jobs are available.
So they may go to New York, have a hard time getting a job, and also find that it's a very expensive place to live.
It's very expensive to live. Yeah, they're coming from all over the country. There's not a specific place, but that's the main reason. The everything is affordable here, and we have very, very good employment rate for our clients. You know, there are entry-level jobs, hotels, casino, but there are jobs available. So that's why they come here, most of them.
And what are the largest refugee and immigrant populations in our region? Who makes up most of the under those two headings?
Okay, so for the last 4 or 5 years, Bhutanese refugees, they are the largest, even those secondary migrants. Within the Bhutanese refugees, the secondary migrants are more than even the ones that were resettled here directly. Then we have Iraqis. We have a lot of Iraqis in Pittsburgh. And a third would be maybe Burmese refugees. But we also have some other African refugees like the Somali and Burundians. But on the top of the list, I'll say Bhutanese, Burmese, then Iraqis.
We're talking with Keir Mugwaniza, who is Director of Community Assistance and Refugee Resettlement at the Northern Area Multi-Service Center. And he is talking about the refugee population in Pittsburgh, as well as looking ahead to the fourth annual celebration of World Refugee Day here in Pittsburgh. And many of us, even those of us who might have grown up here, who speak English as their first language, find it confusing to access local services. It must be that much harder for the refugees and the immigrants transitioning to life here in Pittsburgh. How do they get help finding what they need, and what are the local services here that are available?
Yeah, so you're right. It's really hard for them to access all those services with all the cultural barriers and languages. So that's where we come in as refugee resettlement. We help our refugees who come to Pittsburgh from school enrollment. We help them, the children, or medical, to get them connected to the medical screening. We provide all the basic need for the initial resettlement process. Then after that, there are other programs that we still have as far as employment. We help our client with employment. We help our client with extended services, once they arrive here. And so, but beside the refugee resettlement, there are other providers that, provide help, extended case management. I can tell you about our ISAC program, which is Immigrant and Service Connections, which is a collaboration through Jewish Family and Children Services, which is six agencies that work together just to do service referral and help immigrants and refugees in Pittsburgh. But even within the county, there's an initiative just to streamline the services that are available and see how they can be more helpful and more accessible to refugee and immigrant. That's the International and the Immigrant Advisory Council from the county. And also, that's also part of the plan with Welcoming Pittsburgh is to see how we can improve all that for not only refugees, but immigrants in general.
What are the biggest challenges for people coming from another country when it comes to making a life here?
Okay, so language is one. That's a big one right there. Just to be able to go places and be able to feel like, you can access the services, they have interpretation. They have signs you can read. That's one of them. The other thing, like I said before, is just the cultural adjustments. Mm-hmm. Our clients come from a whole different, type of culture. And some of them have lived in refugee camp for so many years, some of them for like since they were born. So it's very hard to get adjusted to all that. So I'll say language and cultural adjustment is the biggest challenges.
And is there a way that the process of helping immigrants and refugees to assimilate, is there a way that it can be improved or streamlined?
Yeah, I think so. Both. It can be improved and it can be streamlined at the same time. So that's why I think what we're seeing here in Pittsburgh right now with the Welcoming Pittsburgh and the initiative with our county are very, very important to streamline the services. But also we have to remember the role of all these refugees that are here. Most of them have their own community. So and they play a big role for their community integration. Every time you have someone new, it's good to have someone who's already been here from that culture who can help. But it has to be the combination of both. Us as Pittsburghers and people who are coming here new, we all have to work together to make that happen.
We have less than a minute left, but I wanted to talk about what's happening in Market Square on Friday. Mm-hmm. It's the fourth annual celebration. What's going to happen?
So there's going to be cultural performances, dance performances by different refugee groups that are in Pittsburgh. We're going to have food from various cultures that are in Pittsburgh.
That's always good in this town.
Yep. And we're going to have refugees speaking about their experience. So it's going to be a great event, and we hope to see many of Pittsburghers there.
And again, this is on Friday, this Friday in Market Square, and it's going from when to when?
From 11 to 2, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Okay, well, we'll have to find a way to sneak out of here because we're doing a show right in the middle of that. But it sounds like a lot of fun, and we would encourage people to go. We've been talking with Kir Mugwaniza. He's Director of Community Assistance and Refugee Resettlement at the Northern Area Multi-Service Center. Thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. And we welcome your comments and story ideas at ESSPGH@WESA.FM. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.